Black people didn't necessarily take her in, I guess, in that way to say she is ours. She is one of ours.
Right.
So at least in an hour, and I'm speaking of Greg and I, you know, as being Black folks in our circles, Roberta Flack's name is not necessarily listed in the pantheon of great Black female singers. Do you feel that she felt that? Did she have, what was her experience of that?
I can't speak to specific things that she said, but I can know without a doubt that the first couple records not resonating with Black audiences probably freaked her out.
This is the I'm All Over the Place podcast. I'm Dara Starr Tucker.
Greg Bryant here.
And we are so happy today to be joined by none other than Adam Dorn, who's also known as Motion Worker. He is a producer in his own right, but he is also the son of Joel Dorn, who produced Roberta Flack's first five albums. So thank you so much, Adam, for joining us.
Thanks
thank you for being here.
Yeah.
So excited to have this conversation with you today about your dad's work with Roberta and with many other artists. I mean, he was involved in some really historic projects. And so just, I appreciate you for taking this time to talk to us today.
My pleasure. First of all, just so I could say it to you live, like adding Bill Eaton into that video, you have no idea how amazing that is. He's really one of these unsung, like he deserves his own like piece or, exactly. You know, not maybe in this context, but he's so heavy and so unheralded, like, you know, like literally unsung, like the guy's had his hands in so much amazing stuff.
Yeah. Like I said, I did Just the Two of Us and that's where I ran across him and Ralph McDonald, but it really wasn't a deep thing. I was trying to keep it to 60 seconds or 90 or something and just get out of there. But yeah, I didn't really get a chance to investigate him. Was he involved with Roberta's career?
He was involved with Roberta. He was involved with, you know, the interesting thing about the way Atlantic worked is that everyone worked with each other. So Arif Martin, a producer, would still work with my dad and do arrangements for my father. You know, I wouldn't say with, because my father wasn't a musician, but, and then Bill was an arranger that worked, you know, at the studios. I mean, worked independently all over the city, but my father worked with Bill all the time. He worked with Ralph all the time. He worked with Bill Salter, William Salter all the time. Like, they started a production company because Ralph was an incredible record producer. And they saw, similar like a King Curtis, Ralph was like the MD. Like if you were on a session, chances are Ralph hired you. Mm-hmm. And Bill, you know, William Eaton was the arranger. So he would write all like, you know, the horn parts and string parts and all that kind of stuff. And then what a team. I mean, and they brought similar, and we'll get into Roberta, like similar to Roberta, like Ralph brought so many musicians through. He's like the Art Blakey of studio musicians.
Okay.
He brought so many incredible guys through the filter.
Wasn't he the one, if I remember correctly, that reached out to, he was the one that was friends with Grover Washington and brought
when they recorded those tracks, actually Marcus was telling me, because we were babies. I mean, I was like 10, you know, maybe younger. But when they just recorded instrumentals, the guys playing on the tracks had no idea Bill Withers was going to be on the tracks.
Wow.
Okay.
No, on Gutch track. You know what I mean? Grover needed a producer, and Grover was the best, by the way. Like, talk about like a That's king cool. of Philly. Like, Grover was one of the coolest guys ever. I had so many friends that played with him. But back to these guys and Roberta, in a way, because they were all about bringing people through. They were all about, you know, you know, like Marcus Miller was brought through as a studio musician in a lot of ways by Ralph, you know, and these like, and Luther came through Roberta. Marcus came through Roberta. I wouldn't say M2ME came through Roberta, because he had been playing with Miles and he and Reggie Lucas, you know, they made hit, you know, massive hit for her. But like her thing with musicians was she was really tough, but she was really supportive of musicians. Like there's a bass player that lives in Delaware that was in Entombe's camp named Basil Fearington, and he played with Stephanie Mills and Roberta, and like he's incredible musician. And he was like, Roberta was at my wedding. She paid, like she was so supportive. Like she just treated musicians unlike most artists treat musicians. She brought them through. She knew when they needed to leave the coop. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like Luther and Marcus mm-hmm. left at the right time. They were becoming too much to be in her camp. Mm-hmm. And she, you know, so I'm sure it was bittersweet, and she didn't want Luther to not be, you know, but Luther's at this point singing on every TV commercial for every urban based market, you know, mm-hmm. product. You know that Luther sang Miller Genuine Draft and Budweiser at the same time. Hey. You're not supposed to do that. You are not. Yeah. And I just remember I spent a lot of time around him, and he was like, yep, I did it. I didn't care. I wanted that check. And I was like, wow. Go. But you know, Roberta's fascinating because as she's like her own, in a lot of ways, she caused issues for herself more than for musicians or for she was very supportive, but she could sometimes not get out of her own way. Definitely, you know, and it's, I love, by the way, that you focused on the fact that First Time wasn't a hit. It wasn't a hit at all for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. Which, by the way, I still don't know how they won the Grammy like 2.5 years later.
Right.
They must have changed the rules in terms of your release. You know, maybe it was.
Yeah.
Well, I think what they did was they just released it as a single after that.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, that's what maybe allowed
it. Because it was a new edit or something.
Yeah. Yeah. They trimmed it by a minute and released it as a single.
Okay.
Got it. So that makes sense. But she wasn't resonating at all.
Yeah.
She was like an artist lost at sea. And the thing is, and I don't know that people, real fans, would make the connection, but it wasn't really until she did the duet record with Donnie that it blew up, because that was a big record. That was not a small record. And at the same time, within a little while, you know, you get Killing Me Softly, and then everyone knows who she is now. Mm-hmm. She was, you know, she sold like, I don't know the numbers, but it wasn't 4 million. It was like 30,000 records, and people were like, oh, she's wonderful. I don't know where she fits, you know, and it's kind of like that Nina Simone thing where it's like, well, she fits, she's brilliant, you know, and sooner or later folks will catch up.
Mm-hmm.
And they did, you know, mm-hmm. but it really was in a lot of, I mean, my father hung up on Clint Eastwood like 2 times before he, you know what I mean? He was like, it's not you. Why would you call me? You know?
Yeah.
He did the same thing with Miles Davis too. Miles. Hey. Miles called him on a Sunday, like randomly, I think, you know, in the late 60s, and he had just produced that Joe Zawinul record where it's just Zawinul, and it's the
cover that freaks you out.
It didn't freak Miles out. Miles called my old man because he wanted to know who did it, why it was chosen, why that aesthetic was. He loved it. So they talked on the phone. I mean, you know, Miles was awesome, but like to get a phone call from Miles. Hi Miles, tell Wayne and Herbie I said hi, goodbye. You just not believe that, but
no, not but, at all,
but not it is fine. but the thing, and I have a theory about Roberta and Donnie, is that I think she had animosity that Donnie was resonating, and Donnie gets to Atlantic like kind of a little bit after her, and then really strikes a chord and really resonates not only with Black community, but crosses over. And like Donnie's a thing, and he's the genius that we all know he is, like, mm-hmm. and it, boom, people recognize right away. And I think that she, it's so difficult to be political, but I think that she was pissed, you know, mm-hmm. she was like, oh, you know, he's huge and I'm not. And I was here first, and mm-hmm. you know, it's a lot of artistry and ego and, you know, emotions and, you know, struggles with things, you know, she's She's so brilliant that I honestly think that she could not get out of her way. Like, and then honestly, I worked with her on one session. I worked with her on a bunch of sessions, but on one session, she walked in and she was very, if she wasn't feeling it, she'd just leave a session, you know?
Whoa.
And, but to do that when there's like 45 string players or 50 string, you know, like, you know, I saw her leave a session that was an orchestral date. And even at the age of like 17, I was just there in the back in a corner just watching. And I was like, that's not good. You can't, that's not good. Like, that's a very expensive, I'm not in the mood today kind of thing.
What, around what time would that have been?
That would have been like mid late 80s. When Marcus produced a record for her called Oasis. And it was, my father and I refer to it like, because it should have been a hit. Like, the song Oasis was so well made and so well crafted, and it was perfect for what she should be doing. And we just refer to it as like, and even Marcus laughed at this. It was like a 29-foot leap between two buildings 30 feet apart. it was perfect. And you know, like, the all of it is great, and it just, it didn't happen, you know. And it was a very difficult record to see get made, because she would, I use the terms, she would Steely Dan stuff. Not let go of stuff. You know how, like, the whole Steely Dan, they take like a month to get like a guitar solo, or, you know, that kind of thing. She would do stuff like that. And it's just like, it's maddening, because you're just like, you got to let go of things. You got to, you know, you got to make decisions. That, you don't have 3 years to make this record. You got a producer that's working on five other records right now, you know?
Yeah. So, yeah. Wow. I didn't know
this
that.
Was something you said that your dad produced this?
No. No, Marcus Miller produced Oasis.
Okay.
And this was around that time she had like a hit. Remember, she had a hit? Was it Set the Night to
Set
Music?
Set the Night to Music.
Yeah. Yes. Maxie Priest. Was it Maxie Priest?
I don't remember.
And like, totally disparate artists. Like, there's no real connection there in terms of, like, no offense to him, but like, she's Roberta. Like, she's, you know her as one name. Like, I don't think anyone says, that's Maxie. You know, it's Maxie Priest. He's good. Yeah. Sorry, Maxie. Yeah, I did like your stuff. Just saying, Roberta was really heavy, and that was a strange pairing. She had these, like, this period in the 80s where she, like, Peebo Bryson hit and a Maxine Priest hit, but she wasn't, I didn't feel like she was like the Roberta, like the extension of those first 5-6 records. He kind of just did like, well, now we're going for hits. And that's why the Marcus thing was interesting, because there was a bit of that going on, and having been in her band, he really understood how to work with her. But what I thought was really cool, and this flipped me out, is he would call my old man and be like, what do I do now? She's doing this. I need, you know, he would ask for, because he knew those first five records that my old man did, he knew that my old man was put through like the grinder, like on a level. And, you know, She didn't have the same energy in 1988 as she did in 1969. She came in and she knew what she wanted. I think for the first take, or, you know, she recorded like 40 tunes. They recorded, like, that's why, like, a lot of them were on the first take. Those musicians were phenomenal, and they just made the record really quickly. You know, just went in and recorded. And it's, I mean, those records are so good. And I'm glad, I'm so happy you brought up Gene McDaniels. You know, come on.
I wish I could have met him, man. He's a hero.
Man, he was a trip. I only met him like once or twice. And he was super cool. And like, the fact that you had a hit with that song multiple times is so great. I mean, you know, with Les and Eddie, you know, that sold like 3 million records. That was a massive hit for him. But it's just that community of people all working together, and the fact that, you know, Roberta had these like great songs to choose from that weren't hers. You know, no one also mentions that, like, a lot of these songs, you know, you brought this up perfectly, they're covers, you know. First Time, Killing Me Soft, she didn't write those, you know. And I don't know. But I don't want to just monologue, you know, like there's specific, yeah, because it's like I'll just reminisce and get sentimental and just like, I don't know, like I spent a lot of time around her in creative environments, and it was really a trip because I was really a kid, and then I was a kid, like I was 17, 18, and I'd be around her with a different perspective because my old man wasn't there. So I'm watching it and I'm like, I'm not somebody's kid right now. I'm plugging in microphones and I'm on the session. And as a matter of fact, I actually went out of my way to not let her know I was my father's son because I never knew where their relationship was. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? She was pretty contentious. My father didn't have a lot of interest in that. So he wouldn't play into it. And I think that pissed her off. She wanted like fisticuffs and, you know, like some arguing, and I'm not going to do it for you. You know, I'm done. And
he seems so cool. I got a chance to talk to him one time, and I mean cool. And I know he probably had a pretty, you know, aggressive side if he needed to be. But
we're
just
talking
what
about
said,
we're talking about Joel Doran.
Sorry, I'm
sorry. My dad. Yeah,
unaware.
Yeah, my dad.
Adam's dad is Joel Doran. Joel Doran produced. First time ever I saw your face, and you said the first five,
the first five hours.
I didn't realize
flat.
It was that many.
Yeah.
And there's actually a great story about the sixth album where, and I love telling this now because it's so beyond statute of limitations, but Atlantic owed him money, and Roberta was basically producing her sixth record because he just agreed, like, I'm done. Like, mm-hmm. I'm out. Five records this has been tough.
Yeah.
And so she made a record, and Ahmet Erdogan didn't like the mixes. So they called my old man and his engineer, Gene Paul, and they said, listen, can you fix these mixes on the, just keep it quiet, but like, we'll pay you to do your thing because these tracks aren't where we want them. And my father was like, well, you guys, and this is so great. This is such another record business. But my old man was like, well, you guys owe me a bunch of back royalties. Mm. So why don't you give me those royalties and a fee? And we'll do it for you. We'll get you a big hit. So he took the tapes, and I'll never forget it. He took the primary, the master tapes, whatever, you know, and he put them on the sofa. He had them there for 2 weeks. He got his money. And he gave them right back. he never did a thing. He was like, oh, you want to play games and you want me to work with Roberta? Like, you know what? She produced this record and I think it's good. I'm not messing with her vision, but I am getting my money from you guys.
Oh my
God. He got his money. And I love telling that now because it's like, you know, we're talking like 1976. So I'm like, who's going to come? Like that money was probably gone the day he got it, by the way. But I just love, like, people talk about hustlers and like, you know, and I'm like, that's a hustler.
Wow.
And I remember I became really kind of good buddies with M2 Man. I told him that story and he was like, man, that's the best shit ever. Like, you know, you gotta do that to Atlantic, you know, because Atlantic was pretty rough. Jerry Wexler and Ahmet, they could put you through the, you know, the grist mill, you know, they treated it was a great family, but they also like they could mess with you, you know. So yeah, I just think like it's funny, like I would always talk about my old man Roberta, especially when I started getting around her. And he was just like, it's indisputable that she's one of the better artists of her generation. It's just that there was so much overthinking. Like, I don't even know if you guys would notice this, but she refused to license her music for years.
Mm.
She would not let it get used. She would like, I remember she did a, like a perfume commercial. And I remember hearing it. She did like, you'd be so nice to come home to, or whatever, like that standard. And I was like, well, that's Roberta's music. He's like, no. She was hired by an ad agency to sing that. That's not a record that she made. And I was like, wow, you would never hear Killing Me Softly in a movie. You would never, she started out and you heard First Time, but then that shut down. You just didn't hear her music. And I think that was always, especially when licensing became, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s, you know, something where it was extremely profitable. And it would, you know, I'm like, my dad was like, can you please break your own little rule and license some of this music, it'll get the catalog to sell. It'll raise your profile, you know, more than it is at right now. And she just refused, you know. And there were a lot of artists from that generation that did The Doors and Beatles didn't.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they refused and they looked down on it. And I just remember coming up and being like, you can use my music. You can use, you have a car that has four wheels. You can use my, I was like, I'm not going to sell any records. This is how the lights will stay on, you know? Mm-hmm. But she was just so, she was anti that. She did a lot of stuff like that where it would keep things from selling or keep things from being exposed to people that hadn't heard it. I think it was challenging. It was challenging to their relationship on that level. But I will say, in defense of her, they always had like a deep down kind of respect thing and a real, there was a friendship there. It was just on a lot, there were a lot of rules to their friendship. It wasn't, but yeah, she would pop up at times and I would just be like, she could be amazing. And she'd be incredibly supportive and kind. It just, it was on a spectrum.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, and it, you know, now at this point in her life, I know that she's dealing with, you know, major health issues. And, you know, I don't know what her day to day is, but I know that she used a lot of energy on having lots of rules. Like, and I talked to musicians from that worked with her and they all learned on the, you know, there's an ebb and flow. You kind of just feel it out like anyone else really, but you know, I just don't.
Reminded me of someone very specific that I'm not going to call out. I'm going to let Greg ask or tell his story about your dad. And then I have a question specifically about his career that I don't know if you can answer or not, but I'll throw to you and then I'll ask my.
Well, it's actually more of a situation that I feel like they were the perfect artist producer marriage. And I wanted to get Adam, if he could, to kind of tell us about, you know, Joel Dorn's acclimation early on to Black music, because he loved everything and not just that. He loved different things. And to hear how multifaceted Roberta is as an artist, I felt like she needed a producer who was as open and had as open ears. He wasn't an industry guy. He was a music dude. So for people who may not know, like, what kind of music did he grow up really championing that made him want to get into the business in the first place?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
It's Joseph M. Wanted with the Christitutionalist Politics. Tune in for the upcoming episode for May 4. Issue, Never the Issue, as well as guests Peter Serafin, Rosemary Downer, Don Gallade, Gista the Rapper, Cy Young, Jason Perry, and upcoming Jack Hagar, Andrew Thorpe King, Trent Rock, Ed Temple, Chris Morehouse, and more. Please tune in to Christitutionalist Politics. God bless.
When my father was 14, he started a correspondence with Neswee Ertegun, the least talked about Ertegun brother. And Neswee was the co-founder of the label. He came in a little into after they started the label. And Neswee is why they signed Train, why they signed Mingus, why they signed the MJQ, which I still can't believe everyone sleeps on the MJQ. It's like the most elegant intellectual stuff ever. I love them. And my father wrote a letter, not knowing it would get to Neswee. He didn't even know who they were. He heard Ray Charles. And his entire life exploded. Like he was really into music as a kid, but at 14, he was like, nope, this is it. I want to be around this. And he started a correspondence with Neswee, like to the point where they were sending him records when he was like 15, 16. And like Neswee really was like, whoever this kid is in Philadelphia, his spirit and his passion about this. My father would send songs to the label for Ray Charles. He would say he should do this. You know, and they were like, they kept an eye on him. But I also thought it was like they supported it. You know what I mean? It was like kind of very not common for, you know, a 14-year-old kid from like West Philly to, you know, to.
And what period of time would this have been?
It would have been 50, so it's a 42, so 57, 58 in there.
Okay.
And the thing about my father is
Adam, I have one more question because I'm the non like super intense music nerd. So I'm asking for me and then for also for the listeners who don't have the information that you guys have. What type of music was Atlantic creating at that time?
Atlantic was literally the epicenter of like blues meeting rock, meeting jazz, meeting gospel, meeting blues. So, and what they did, unlike most labels, is they were just like, you make great music, we don't care who you are. You could be Jewish, you could be black, you could be, because it was started by Turkish guys and a really aggressive Jewish guy named Jerry Wexler. And they were like, we want the best music on the planet.
So this is the Ray Charles movie. This is the label that he signed with initially, his first label, correct?
And it's arguably where he did some of his best.
I agree.
Because that's where Hank Crawford and Fathead and those little big bands, and that's just, those are machines. They are, those bands, you know, and they continued, but it wasn't the same, in my opinion. Like, mm-hmm. There's that magic you get when an artist finds their voice and they get like a 4-year run where it's just like, I mean, what I say, I mean, just like, you know, You Be My Baby, like those records, I can listen to What I Say top to bottom. And it's like the entire record is like Sgt. Pepper's to me. It's mm-hmm. like, it is genius. But mm-hmm. to continue, the Atlantic experience and my father's experience are very similar. My father grew up in a 50-50 neighborhood. Most of his friends were black. You know, he had my father-in-law was actually his childhood best friend, my dad's friend, Cosmo, an Italian kid from Philly. But I'm just saying, like, it was a unique experience in Philadelphia to live in a very integrated section of the city. And that, you know, hey, it's just, you're exposed to music that you wouldn't hear, and you're open to so many things that I think it just, it charted the course for my father's creative and musical journey. Just not
ignorant, you know. Ignorant question. Was your dad Jewish?
Yeah, I think he still is. <Wherever he goes. laughs> I would like to think that he would remain Jewish. Okay. Yeah, he was Jewish. And, you know, our full name is Dornblum, actually. And he had to shorten it. He didn't have to, but it was like common practice. You know, in the 50s and 60s, Jews in this country just, mm-hmm. you know, you went from Goldstein to Gold, right. You know, you just did that. I continued it because I figured I'd follow my dad's footsteps, and it's Dorn, you know, I mean, that's how it's known. But, and Dornblum's an ugly name. Like, on bass, Adam Dornblum, like, that doesn't mean anything. Like, you know, yeah. Oh, he's so funky. You know, so he really grew up in an integrated environment, and Atlantic was the perfect place to land because of that, because he was so mm-hmm. schooled and just immersed in all music. I mean, you know, his primary focus was jazz and R&B, and that's mm-hmm. where you go. If you want to produce records in the mid-60s, Atlantic is, you know, other than Motown, which didn't really do anything other than Motown was Motown. They didn't do a lot of string.
Right. Really? I have one more question, Darn, before you. And it's interesting on Joel Dorn's path that he becomes a radio DJ the, you know, step between, you know, and one of the people he meets on his jazz radio journey is Les McCann.
Oh, yeah.
Talk about that, because that has a Roberta connection eventually.
It's a major Roberta connection. It's the Roberta connection. Actually, Les and Rahsaan. Rahsaan was a
Rahsaan
connection.
Kurt. Mm-hmm.
But also at the radio station was Ed Bradley from 60 Minutes.
Oh, wow.
Whoa.
On the FM side. So they shared the studio overnights, and Ed and my father worked together for years, 3 years, you know, at the station while they were at Temple University. And Les is just one of those guys. Have you ever met Les? Have you guys ever been around Les?
We talked over the phone, had another great conversation, but I don't know him like you.
No, hey, I mean, He's just one of those guys, you meet him and like you could be friends with him in 30 seconds. Like, he's just great. And I think he came in to the station and my father and Les just hit it off. Like, literally just became buddies. And the thing is, the station was the final connection to my father getting to Atlantic. So if you think about it, if you're Atlantic Records and you've been corresponding, you know, you're Neswi Ertegun, you've been corresponding with this kid in Philly who now is on the top jazz station in the city, where that meant, that really meant a lot to Atlantic because he could break their records. He could literally, they saw regional spikes in sales because he supported them. And it wasn't like, it wasn't.
What station was this?
What's that?
What station?
Oh, WHAT. It was Temple. Temple University had a jazz station called WHAT, which cracked me up because it spells what. But but he was on the station, and all artists that came through that played at the Showboat or I'm trying to remember the other major.
Peps
or the Showboat. My father effectively would sometimes be the MC on those gigs. Or take the guys around town. Like, so, you know, Ming, like, my father became friends with everyone. He became friends with Cannonball. He became friends with, if you can, you know, believe it or not, he was friends with Mingus. He was friends with, you know, the Crusaders. Like, anyone who came through, they just, it was instant community and connection. And he was really doing good work for Atlantic without even being an employee. And at a certain point they were like, would you want to come into the fold? Cause you're really doing, you're breaking records that we didn't think would sell the way they are. So we kind of owe you. So they gave him a shot, you know, in 64, I think was the year.
That's awesome.
And he would have been 22. And the first record that he did for them was a Sonny Stitt record. Called Deuces Wild. And the best aspect of that record, what a great intro to the record business, is that Sonny, because he was always recording, Sonny had already recorded the record with another label. He just did the same songs in the same order. And they went in and Atlantic ended up buying the other record. And they're like, you know, and my father couldn't have known. But what a great entry to, you know, such a treacherous business that the first record you produced was already made by the artist for another label. It's just, it's so incredible. You can't write that. It's like, you know, Woody Allen meets someone. I don't know. But so, yeah, he was like, whoa, all right, got to get over this hurdle. Jeez. But yeah, Les in particular, I remember, and I'll tell like a PG version of it, but Les just kept calling my dad about Roberta. My dad was like hanging up on him at a certain point. He's like, I don't need another, you know, like he was working with Bette Midler and he was working with like, he was like, I don't need it, like a nightmare artist. Like, I don't want, and he had a premonition that she was going to be rough and he was right. And you know, might be sexist. It might be whatever, you know, stereotyping, but like I'm sure that there's not enough Maalocs in North America to replenish what he took while he was working. You know what I mean? Like,
well,
you know,
I think they put the quote in the, have you seen the Roberta documentary on that?
I haven't watched it just because it's too emotional for me. Like, oh, yeah. For some reason, once lots of folks blew up my phone and they were like, oh, you need to watch this American Masters. And they do incredible stuff. Yeah. Like, they did that Miles doc. I loved that Miles doc that Aaron and Vince did. But I just was like, I would ask friends, like, just please tell me it wasn't made by her camp. Like, is it balanced? Is it even? And I heard it was. I heard it was kind of great, you know? Bless you. Did you like it?
I was going to say I don't know if there's a quote that I found online or if it's in the documentary, but I think I put it in my piece because I used a lot of footage of the documentary in the piece that I did for the breakdown. But there are quotes of him saying, I don't want to work with any more chick singers. I don't want to work with any more female singers because they were nothing but problems. There were no quotes of him saying that she was a problem, but.
No. Just in general, like, it's funny. You know, we worked together. He really produced it, but I did a couple things. But we worked with You know Jane Monheit? Do you know
Jane? Yeah.
He's a total sweetheart. And mm-hmm. I remember my dad was about 60 and he was like, finally an artist that just goes, I like how that sounds. that was a good take. Thank you so much for helping me get to that great take. So he's like, where were you in 1968? You know? And she's such a sweetheart and so, you know, she's great, but I, you know, just whatever.
She's actually a friend of ours. I saw that the other day. I did not realize that she had worked with your dad. I think it's called Surrender. Is it Surrender? That album?
There's like two or three records, okay. I think. Yeah, yeah. It's like he got her signed and then did well. She had a nice pop to the beginning of her career. And those were so much fun records. It was great to be around them. Like I was working on tons of other things and I would just visit my dad in the studio with no, you know, I love visiting sessions when I have no responsibility. You know what I mean? Like, so I would just come in. I think I played on one thing. She wanted to do a cover of a Bonnie Raitt tune. I don't know if it made a record, but she's just the best. She's a total sweetheart. We had a great time. And it was like Buster Williams and Ron Carter and Fathead and like just great musicians. You just get to sit and watch record. You know, it was great. But back to, I don't want to digress, back to, you know, Roberta getting to the label. Rahsaan and Les were really instrumental. Mm-hmm. And my father at a certain point, I remember you used a clip and he was like, you know what? We'll sign her. I know Wexler was like, sign her. Too many musicians are talking about her. Too many people are excited about this school teacher playing in DC and just like everyone goes through. All the musicians would go through her gig and check it out. So it's like, it's a no brainer. You just sign her. And that's why I think they recorded like 40 things because they didn't know from a production standpoint, like let her do her thing. Let's see what we have. You know, that's why you record 40 songs. I'd love to hear all 40, you know, I have no idea where they are. There's rumors that, you know, Atlantic stored their tape library in like a non temperature controlled location that got burned down.
Mm.
A lot of famous Atlantic, you know, recordings that are just gone forever, you know, because they wanted to save money on storage. So of course that's what happens. It was like a department store that had an attic and it was one of the guys at the label. It was like his family owned the store. So they're like, well, put the tapes there. Such a dumb move. It's like a short-sighted, you know, budget move. But I wonder if those tapes are around. I have, I actually have test pressings of a bunch of Roberta stuff with my father's notes on, you know, so I have Killing Me Softly mix 12.
Wow.
And I don't know if that's the mix. That's the thing. Like, and I don't want to play test pressings because they wear out, you know, they're acetate. They're not vinyl, but, you know, that's one of the wilder things is that like, you know, she gets there and they know they have something, but they don't know what to do with the something they have. She was very challenging she's an artist for everyone, but labels are so short-sighted. You know, I remember my father produced the Neville Brothers for A&M and they're like, oh, we'll work it to Black Radio. And it's like, no, you don't work the Neville Brothers to Black Radio. You work the Neville's to radio. Like you know, it's the short-sightedness and it's kind of racist, actually. Like, music just be, oh, this is Black music. And it's like, no, it's not. Roberta is like Americana and folk and jazz and R&B. And it's everything. So, you know, no wonder you didn't sell records for a couple of years. You didn't promote this to everyone, you know? And it's such a hallmark of the, I think labels, well, now it's different, but labels really shot themselves in the foot with assumptions, you know, about where artists would resonate and not resonate. You know, she obviously did really resonate. It just took a couple of years. And thankfully it did, you know.
Well, he produced, because I'm getting ready to do also an episode, a breakdown on Killing Me Softly. So he produced, it sounds like you're saying he did that one as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Okay. And that's the one that made everything explode. First Time was a big hit, you know, Killing Me Softly was a world beater. Mm-hmm. It was number one in like, I don't know how many cars. It was like ridiculous. I wish that I was like 6-7 years older so I could just be like, oh, do you have the number one record in the world? You know, like with my, you know, my, meanwhile, my friends in suburban Philly would not even know what the hell that means. but he did Killing Me Softly. And there's an interesting story about it that I think Roberta would refute, but I think it's pretty hard to refute because I have two people who told me the same story, which is Killing Me Softly. If you think about it, the lead instrument on Killing Me Softly is a kick drum. Mm. It's the loudest thing in the mix. It's louder than her. And it changed. A guy named Gene Paul mixed it. And Gene is the son of Les Paul. Mm. And Les Paul had a lot to do with multi-track recording and inventing multi-track recording. But he was smart enough to send Gene to Atlantic to learn from Tom Dowd. And Tom Dowd is like, you know, one of the best engineers ever. And one of the better producers ever, easily. And my father and Gene had this idea to have this like heartbeat kick, just like pull you in. Mm. And they worked on it for really not a short amount of time. They mixed Killing Me Softly, my father said, was like months before they got the mix that they wanted and had to fight back and forth with her because she was on the road when they were mixing it. So they're mixing this record and she's only hearing, you can imagine as an artist, you want control over how the recordings are, you know, and I don't blame her. I mean, as an artist myself, I wouldn't want someone mixing my music for months and I'm out on the road. And what does it sound like? Are you ruining it? Like if you're prone to like not trusting and, you know, but that record changed a lot about how basically R&B records and soul records were mixed. I mean, like, you don't get to D'Angelo without having that kind of, like, that concept of, like, kick drum in the lead, everything coming back out like a, you know, it's almost like a, you know, comes to a point, you know, and the vocal just floats over everything. Mm. It's a wild thing. He produced that record, and he was fiercely proud of it because I think he and Gene worked so hard on it, and they would always kind of, like, Heisman Trophy her because they were like, no, we're on to something. We are not changing this mix. There was a lot of contention and fighting. Mm-hmm. And I hate to not agree with an artist and I hate to not agree. I mean, but she was wrong. Mm-hmm. She was wrong. I mean, that record is defining and such a classic for a reason. And it means in that place and time, you know, it's wild. Like my father would always talk about like making records and, you know, you have a run. You have like, you know, even Ringo Starr was like, you get like 8-10 years maybe. And then, you know, it's different. And when you're in it and you really know something's great, you got to fight for it. Like when you're at that height of your creative, you know, and some people, you know, shit, some people go for decades, but you know, it's tough. And mm-hmm. I can see where all that fighting was and all that lack mm-hmm. of trust. And you know, I don't know. I honestly would also say there may have been, and I don't want to be like, you know, I don't want to cause like controversy, but there may have been some racial components. There may have been, there was, you know, I know Donnie was really leery of, you know, working with white producers and like he worked with Arif. And there's a great story in the, do you guys see that there's a King Curtis book? There's no, a, I'd love to get there's a book about Curtis and there's a story in it. And I think Layla Hathaway is pissed at me, but basically I shared it with Layla because I had told her, you know, your old man did this thing in the studio with Curtis and like, it's a real story. And she's like, he didn't do that. And I'm like, okay, well, here it is in the book. Curtis and my father produced Donnie on something. Mm. And Donnie was like, I don't want Joel on the record. I just want Curtis to produce it. So Curtis was like, listen, we're both going to produce it and Joel will stay in the control room. So my father just dummied up and, you know, just is like, I'll just stay in here, Mr. Hathaway. Like he ended up producing him like 2 years later and now Reef Martin produced him and, you know, but Donnie was pissed at Curtis because he felt like he was going back and forth and saying bad shit. So at the end of the day, he knew they were staying there to do other work. He put tape recorders all through the studio and he captured Curtis saying all this bad shit about him. Wow. And he took it to Amit and Wexler and Curtis had to apologize to everyone. My father was like, I couldn't believe it. I could not believe. I mean, and meanwhile, Donnie was right. Donnie was totally right. I don't think he was right about my dad, because my dad didn't say shit. And he was like, you know, he's like, hey, I'm here because I'm at the label and we got to do this record, you know. So, but there was this country. I mean, there's just, there were really, as inclusive as Atlantic was, you can't fight that. You know, they're still like, artists want to be artists, and they want to, you know, Donnie could have easily produced himself, you know, hell of an arranger, but Arif Martin is a perfect foil for Donnie because he's equally as good an arranger, if not actually maybe a little more schooled. So they did okay. Arif and Donnie, it worked out. And I love that Arif has Donnie and my father has Roberta, and they come together for the duet record and they killed it. You know, they were really dear friends, and I'm dear friends with Arif's son as a result. Like, we were tight. It was like good family friends. A lot of Atlantic was about kind of that experience too. I mean, it was a complicated place because at the bottom of it, it's business.
Yeah. So, yeah.
You know, you just want, it's just like, well, you get a hit. You know, you just hear Jerry Wexler yelling, get a hit. I don't get back in there and fix it. You know?
Yeah.
So it's like old school meets like these guys really changing the course of what was coming up until disco. And then they all suffered except for Arif, who produced the Bee Gees. Arif did okay. And Shaka and Norah Jones, like Arif had a career for like 50 years, you know, unbelievably always having hits. I was like, damn. But yeah, no, there were the Killing Me Softly record is fascinating because the fact that they got to mix that without her, I think really probably set the stage for her to just be like, I'm done with produce, like I'm out. And do you know her about her moniker, like her producer moniker, Rubina?
Oh, Rubina Flake, yeah.
Yeah. So she was just like, I need to do this, and I have to say, even though it was my father, who I don't know if he was ousted or not, I think he had enough too. It was like amicable split. Mm-hmm. I think she should produce herself. Like that's that record business thing where it's like, how many millions of records do you need to sell? And with this goal of like, I want control over my artistry. Mm-hmm. It's like so many other artists got it then. I'm glad they gave her like the shot to do it. And then I'm glad that she was smart enough to bring M2MAY and Reggie Lucas and those guys in on the next record, because you know you need a team, you know, especially in that, you know, you can't.
So the thing that you're referring to, this Rubina Flake, for people who don't know, this is, can you explain what that was?
Well, okay, so it's for me, it's like three layers to it. You have a black female artist in an extremely patriarchal business. Mm-hmm. Saying that she wants to produce herself. You have an artist that has sold millions of records and is basically like, she's a genius, but women weren't producers then. Black women weren't producers then, or if they were, they were uncredited, you know, like the typical nonsense of this country's history. So she had every kind of eight ball. She was behind like six eight balls, you know, like the label didn't want her to produce herself. She's a woman. She's a woman of color. Like, it's just, you know, it's not a good scenario. And she forced her way into the situation of producing herself, but she chose a moniker so it wouldn't, the pressure wouldn't be like, oh, Roberta Flack produced herself and it's a failure or whatever. She has this fake name, you know, which is obviously, I mean, Rubina Flake, there's no one named. So it's really funny. And I think, you know, there also may have been some weird contractual things and technicalities, but I think the first part of my answer is really the truth. It's just like, you know, it's hard enough to give artists certain freedoms in that era, but then you're talking about a black woman in the early 70s. It's just labels weren't progressive and they didn't think, you know, they didn't get out of their own way to let people like, hey, I got a vision on this, let me do it. Because it became really commonplace in the next 10 years. I mean, you know, give or take. But yeah, just another, you know, it's weird. I say all of that and I still think like my father's contribution to her career and their partnership, when it worked, was incredible. And it doesn't take away from her, you know, she probably learned a lot watching those records get made. She had never really been in the studio before. So it's like, you know, she can't just come in and produce herself from Jump Street. It just doesn't work that way, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's that kind of on that. But
I want to figure out the best way to ask this question. So when you have a hit as big as Killing Me Softly, it's great for everybody. But on the other hand, when you have someone as creative as Joel Dorn, who also likes the underdog and champions the underdog,
right,
how much harder is it then to produce somebody like Rahsaan Roland Kirk, or an artist who his heart is with, but they aren't having the same numbers? Or
not hard at all.
Okay. Because
I know that when he got to Atlantic, part of why he went back there was to bring Rahsaan hadn't been on the label, but Fathead and Hank and Mingus. He brought artists back into the fold mm-hmm. that he thought should never have left. They should never have been allowed to leave. And I think he treated those records as like, this is kind of why I'm here. These are guys that I love. These are my friends. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it was difficult at all. You know, thing you have to remember is like he could be working with Yusef Lateef. Yusef, Hank, mm-hmm. Roberta, and Bette Midler in the same week. Records weren't like siloed like they became in the 80s, where like you have some massive producer and they work with the same act for like a solid year. Mm-hmm. You know, they worked on stuff all the time, mm-hmm. constantly. So mm-hmm. I think he loved working with those artists, but then like when I don't think he ever expected to have a scenario like a Roberta or a Bette Midler where it's like something sold millions of copies. And now he was never really in that mindset, like, I'm going to go produce Carole King. I'm going to go produce, you know, he wasn't like a corporate company, not that they're corporate, but I'm just saying he was never had that lust for, I need to produce this huge act now, like that I produce these, you know, he was always like, I want these acts to get the attention they deserve. And mm-hmm. and these are the acts I love, you know. And not that he didn't love Roberta, but he loved Roberta for, I think, for some different reasons. But like Fathead or Hank or Les and Eddie, or that was like family, you know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it was never a challenge. I think the real challenge was like more about figuring out the politics of Atlantic. He never was political that way. Because he would watch Arif play the game perfectly. And my father was too, he wore it on his sleeve, you know. He was like, I just want to make a great Rahsaan record, you know, like, come on, you know, I know we're going to sell like 21,000 units or whatever, but he was all about that. And he compromised some things, like the label offered him a really nice contract to stay there. And he just said, no, he wanted to keep working on, you know, in the disco era, he floundered. Because I was like, dude, in retrospect, I'm like, take the contract and ride out disco, you know. You're not going to stay in Atlantic and make jazz records, you know, for a guaranteed income. But, you know, I think that a little of that happened to all those artists at that time. Like disco really threw it off, you know. Mm. I mean, Roberta had a dip. She came back in the mid 80s, you know. A lot of stuff changed. But I will say my favorite thing about her, though, is the way that and I know we weren't talking about her specifically, but it just dawned on me, and I said this earlier, the musicians that worked with her that loved her so much. Like, and I knew like multiple generations of people like that went through, especially bass players. Like my friend Jerry Barnes and his sister Catrice, like they were like mentored by Roberta, like 25 years after she had her first hits. They were like, Catrice was like her MD. You know, mm. like, you know, like, and they loved her. They knew that there was ups and downs and that, you know, there were difficulties on the road and that there's going to be some moments, but she really, she's a consummate musician, and she's great with musicians, you know? And I think that's so important if you're going to be an artist like that, like, you know, not subjecting them to the drama, not subjecting them to, you know, they're like the family that, you know, you need, and you treat them with respect. And, you know, she was great at that. I never heard any musician say like, oh, I hated her. Like, you know, this is, you know, she was very generous with the folks that work with her. And that's extremely admirable, because all of us know that's not like the case most of the time. You know, if you work for someone, I remember the first time I went on the road, I thought, well, we're all on the road, so we're all friends. And it's like, no, the artist is separate car, separate flight, separate sections of, you know, like, you don't know the artist. And it was like, I was so naive. I was like, oh man, I made the record and we were buddies in the studio and now we're in Europe and it's like, I don't exist. And it's like, no, that's how it works. You know, but she wasn't like that. She'd go to people's weddings and have, you know, she's good people that way. She's great people that way. But
well, I have a question kind of about her. You may or may not have any insight into this, but I guess I took one segment, a kind of a significant segment in the breakdown that I did on this to talk about kind of how she stands in the lineage, I guess, of Black female singers, and how she is kind of the continuation of Nina Simone, how she sort of picked up right where Nina Simone left off. She definitely had, well, I don't know. She I guess she had more commercial success. She did have more commercial success for longer. She had, has had a much longer career than Nina ever did. And obviously a lot of their personal things have influenced that.
Yes.
But when people talk about Roberta in terms of these, you know, just I'll stick to just the Black female singers, just the great Black female singers of her time, really, 70s and 80s. I don't necessarily always hear Roberta's name called in that group. I mean, you talk about Gladys Knight, Aretha Franklin, Chaka Khan, and we could go on and on. Whitney Houston, you know, in the 80s, Roberta's name is rarely called in that group. And I feel like on one hand, it could be kind of a, I don't know, like a Natalie Cole situation. There was another singer that came to mind that might kind of occupy a little bit of the same territory of like Donna Summer, you know, who was really more famous with mainstream audiences. Her hits were on the pop chart. She was not just an R&B or soul singer, and she really was a mainstream artist, and Black people didn't necessarily take her in, I guess, in that way to say she is ours. She is one of ours. Right. So at least in an hour, and I'm speaking of Greg and I, you know, as being Black folks in our circles, Roberta Flack's name is not necessarily listed in the pantheon of great Black female singers. Do you feel that she felt that? Did she have, what was her experience of that?
I can't speak to specific things that she said, but I can know without a doubt that the first couple of records not resonating with Black audiences probably freaked her out.
Mm.
And, you know,
and those were pretty Black records from what I've heard. I mean, I can't say I've been deep into it, but from what I've heard, they are.
They are, and they're filled with so much social consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Political, you know, I mean, compared to what is as political a song as you can get, you know, what I mean? Really is, it could, if done correctly now, it could still be a hit. You know what I mean? So I think that she's of the world. She's not to be pigeonholed into any one community. Mm-hmm. And I think that the good part of that is that she's like, you know, world level renowned. But within Black music, I don't think that, you know, she's not in that Aretha Shaka. She just isn't. And it's weird to me because Nina, by the way, I think mm-hmm. you bring up Nina, and I think it's a fascinating connection because Nina, who sabotaged things, and I have an interesting story about Nina, but Nina who sabotaged certain things and then she had mental illness and she had addiction. And look at her career in the last 20 years, though. Mm-hmm. She has, her estate has made more money and had more success than many, many other artists. Mm-hmm. The licensing alone and the way that Nina Simone's thing, it's, I think, similarly to Rahsaan, there are artists that it's like, she happens to be Black, but she's a world artist and it'll take folks a while to catch up. Mm-hmm. I think Roberta is someone that is ripe, and I hate to say this because it means, you know, her demise has to occur, but I think Roberta is really primed for, like, I'll call it the Robertasance, like a renaissance of, like, she's so great and timeless mm-hmm. that it transcends whatever her disappointments may have been with the specific community embracing her or not.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that Donnie's success, his hyper Black success, while she didn't resonate with Black audiences, really irked her. And that in order for her to resonate with Black audiences, she had to do a duet record with him. That is the first record for her that was a hit.
Mm.
That introduced her to a lot of Black audiences, because I think, and Greg, both of you will dig this, I think she was getting played on jazz radio, and let's face it, not a ton of people even then were listening to jazz radio. She was compartmentalized in a specific subsection of genres. So she just doesn't have that, while I think she should. Once again, it's a matter of race. If she was a white artist singing Killing Me Softly or singing First Time Ever I Saw Your Face angelically like Roberta is, I think we have a different level of, you know, she'll resonate with white audiences and Black, you know, and Black audiences. Mm. I think Roberta is tricky and confusing to some folks because she doesn't have that energetic, guttural thing that I think a lot of people look for when they say things like Black music or R&B, whatever. Bullshit. She mm-hmm. is a singer-songwriter. She is an artist. And I just think a lot of people don't really still to this day get how great she is and get how masterful she is at what she does. You know, mm-hmm. I hope that makes some sort of sense. I think, you know.
It does. But I want to ask you with what you saw, you're a little older than us. And I specifically remember in the 80s as a little kid seeing Black women and Black men, for that matter, amazing singers. But I didn't know they even played instruments because the whole record company thing was put them out front with a microphone. Don't attach them to an instrument. So but I remember stupid. In high school when D'Angelo comes out.
Right.
I was already hip to Donny Hathaway, but I was like, this is the first time that I have seen a Black artist blow up that is attached to an instrument.
Yep.
Have you seen Stevie, maybe. Other than Stevie Wonder? That's perfect. Exactly.
Oh, yeah. But he already went back 30 years prior, too. So, yeah.
Correct. Did you see the same thing coming up and being in the studio? Was that even a consideration? The labels were like, if they play, we don't want to know about it in the video. Let them.
You know, it's weird. Regarding Roberta, especially in the 80s, I felt a concerted effort to make pop records from her. Like those duets with Peebo or Maxie or, you know, the kind of record she made with Marcus was like, they're going for a pop record. They wanted to be a Black pop record, but they were going for a pop record. And they're definitely, and I never understand this, I think the artists and the labels are combined in this sort of notion of like, get on the mic, don't sit at the piano. Like, she was very much a sit at the piano kind of artist. And I even remember Marcus would call my old man and just say like, I'm having a hard time in this scenario. My father would be like, put her at the piano. If you put her at the piano when she does her vocals, there's a different relationship and synergy between the instrument and her voice. And it sits her in a different realm. You know, listen, the 80s were The 80s were an interesting era. Videos were really, if you go back and look at those videos, they're really whack. They're like, you know, they're really stupid. And they're trying to make her up and, you know, give her some sex appeal. You know, like there's all sorts of stuff going on. And it's like, throw some of that out the window. You know what I mean?
Yeah, when you're talking about Marcus, you're speaking of Marcus Miller.
Yeah.
Okay. Who is?
One of the world's best bass players. And you have two bass players on this Zoom. That would agree to that. And he was Luther Vandross's partner in production. I think he did about 11 or 12, you know, albums with Luther. They were both in Roberta's band before they became the producer and the artist that they both became, or Marcus, in all fairness, as an artist as well. But yeah, sorry. I'm talking to friends, so I'm just saying, cool. Marcus. Everyone knows Marcus. Yeah.
Cool.
But there was this incredible, because we earlier were talking about Ralph McDonald and Marcus and Luther, and like, think about the tentacles between coming through Roberta's filter in a pop thing. Luther sings all the backgrounds on Chic Records. That's Luther. If you listen to Chic, that's pure Luther at the point. Like, it's totally him arranging those vocals, and like, you know, and all these people, they worked on so many different records. You know what I mean? Like, they worked together and made Magic and Art and Hits, and then they went off on their own and made Hits, and then they worked with other, you know, that's the thing right now. I think when you ask me, like, what was the last artist you saw sit down at a keyboard or play guitar or whatever, that stuff happened because of that community, because of musicians that were writing songs and artists that were really musicians that were writing songs. It was all fostered. Maybe on the label front, certain female artists were taken away from the, you know, the piano or whatever, but that's not now. Now is not about that. And it's a drag, because every once in a while, like, even if you look like at Anderson .Paak playing the crap out of drums, like, that to me is just like, ah, finally, like, someone that's playing an instrument that's also writing the songs, and you see them partaking in the music, not just up on a mic, you know. It's interesting that you bring that up, because I really can't think of too many artists that I think of as musicians that are artists. They're generally like, you're the pop star, and, you know, we throw Ariana Grande out on stage and, you know, whatever, you know, it's like, that's what it's kind of become. But that Roberta, when she toured in the 80s, she sat at that piano and she sat at keyboards. So she always maintained musicianship. She's a hell of a musician. I mean, she went to, did she go to Howard at 15, or did she? She was 15.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's bananas. Yeah. You know, so musicianship and Roberta is like, boom. They're, you know, they are one and the same. And I think that's why she really got along with the musicians. You know, even when it was rocky, like, they always shared that experience. You know, the musicianship and the arrangements and reharming songs, like, that's the part where I'm like, she had incredible musicians in her bands. So definitely I wouldn't confuse her for whatever she was doing in the '80s was not, you know, that was an extension into let's have some hits, you know.
Yeah.
Different artists, you know.
This is such good info. You said you had a story on the Nina, I'm kind of curious.
Oh, so, I'll get intimate. It's a wild story. Nina wanted to be signed to Atlantic. And my father was producing Roberta and Bette around the time that she put feelers out to my father. And my father, his thinking was, I don't think it's a great fit. And if I'm the producer, I don't have the bandwidth to produce Nina Simone and Roberta and Bette.
Bette Midler.
Mm-hmm.
Bette Midler. Sorry, Bette Midler. He signed Bette Midler and he produced the first record. And it was big. It was a big hit. And she obviously became like a generational artist. Mm-hmm. So, and however way he told Nina that it wasn't going to happen, he just couldn't, he didn't have the bandwidth. He couldn't produce Nina and these other artists. Plus, he had all the other roster that, you know, like about six more artists that he was producing. So she didn't take it well. I don't know where she was in her life, where she was living or what was going on, but she tried to hire guys to kill my father. And I've talked about this with people from the estate. Yeah. So my father, luckily, because the record business was a very different thing in this era, there was people involved that were, you know, they ran other businesses, and they, you know, basically it was a lot of mafia in the record business or adjacent to it. So luckily, the guys that she called in Chicago worked for guys that my dad was friendly with, you know. So he got a call. This is another one of those statute of limitations record stories. I don't care. I can tell this. He got a call like, hey, we're going to sort something out. Someone's trying to have you killed. And he was like, who's trying to have me killed? You know, like he's thinking like, you know, some rival artist, you know, whatever. Well, it was a rival artist. So I remember as like a 4-year-old or a 3-year-old, dudes outside of our house. And I remember asking my dad, I'm like, why are there two guys like hanging around the house? You know, and then I asked him a couple years later and he's like, I can tell you now. And he explained to me like, just while they were figuring out to make sure nothing bad happened, these guys were hanging. I'm like, and I love how hip hop thinks it's so hardcore. I'm like, Nina Simone tried to have my old man killed. That's more hip hop than any hip hop shit ever. I was like, that is so cool. And the messed up thing is, I remember like on one of my records, I got the rights to her song Blackbird to do like this arrangement. And my father was like, no, she tried to have me killed. And I was like, but she's a genius. And he was like, but she tried to have me killed. And I was like, I don't care. I love her. And she isn't around anymore. And I want to do an arrangement. I worked on a remix record with the estate. I love Nina Simone. And I would have produced her. I would have been like, I don't care about your band with knucklehead. You produced Nina. And I'm sure it was, you know, really difficult. But I love, I remember I'm trying to think who I met. I was like,
that's the great
story. It wasn't her daughter, but I met someone like somewhat connected to the estate. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, I'm working on this in light of the fact that she tried to murder my father. And they just said like, what? Yeah. But that's what this is all. It's all riddled with these kinds of tales, you know, like these insane, you know, stories about these legends that are legends for a reason, you know, mm-hmm. Nina. Ooh,
yeah,
it does not get much better, but a lot comes with that. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like you can't be that great without like, you know, like some imbalance. But yeah, so I don't know if that's ending on a high note or a happy note. but it's definitely a unique note.
My man.
I just have one clarifying question about your dad. And his role at Atlantic Records. And I didn't want to let you go without asking this because it's just such a curious thing to me about the way the business worked then. And I don't know if it's still that way now. But he's called a producer. That's kind of how he's referred to and how you said he was hired on. But then it sounds like he's working more in kind of an A&R role with how he brought her in and many others. So was he both?
He was both. Because you're at that point, you're called a staff producer, and you're sort of tasked with overseeing and making the records, working with the artists, but you also have to find artists. You have to, you know, A&R really became a different thing, I think, you know, further into the 70s and 80s, you know, especially like in the 90s, it was like, A&R was this really weird thing where it was like I would be producing a record and the A&R person maybe 20 years ago would be a producer and an A&R person, but they were just strictly finding the talent. Mm. So they would come in the studio and I'd be like, you're not a producer. You literally don't know how to produce at all. But you're thinking that it's 20 years ago, so let's take the foot off the gas pedal. But yeah, he was a staff producer. He signed some artists. He also had artists assigned to him. Like the label would sign an artist and they would say, hey, can you produce this artist? We just found, you know, I can't think of any particular artist that was assigned to him, but, you know, but you worked for the label and they gave you a royalty based on the production, but nothing like what happened in like the 70s, like in the 80s and 90s, producers started getting like giant royalties. Like their royalties back then were like 1%, 2%, whatever. Like now it turned into like guys were getting like, you know, $1 million to produce a record plus 6 points plus, you know, all sorts of, you know, pieces of things. That generation of producers didn't make that kind of, I mean, they did if they kept going, like a Reef or Tommy La Puma or certain guys, but yeah, staff producer.
Okay.
So, employee of the label.
Very interesting. Mm-hmm. And I want to,
my pleasure.
Yeah. And can you also, Adam, tell us about what you have going on? Cause I want to include that as well. Just, are there things that you want people to know about? What do you have going on?
Sure. So I'm primarily now like a documentary film composer, and I work on like, it's weird. I do action, really violent action films as a composer, or documentaries, and documentaries have my heart. I'm finishing up civil rights documentary right now, about a town in Maryland where there was a segregated amusement park that Jews and Blacks helped forcibly open this amusement park. It's called Ain't No Back to a Merry-Go-Round. And it's basically about the initial Howard University students and local hyper-liberal Jews working together in this town called Bannockburn to open up this amusement park. And it's a beautiful story. I just finished the score for that. I just finished the score for a doc that's going to be on American Masters, similar to Roberta Flack's documentary about Governor Jerry Brown.
Oh, wow.
Which is, it's a good film. Interesting career. Like, it's funny. I didn't really know as much about him as I thought I did, but I've done a lot of other, like I did a documentary about Richard Pryor, a documentary about Robin Williams, multiple docs about Donald J. Trump, which there was not enough edibles on the planet after I finished scoring. But I've worked, you know, tons of documentaries, a lot of political docs, civil rights docs. And after doing the albums for I think I put out about 8 or 9 albums, it was a nice transition into for a career, you know, stay at home, raise my kid, not tour, score films. So
where can people find you on socials? Do you want people to find you on socials?
Sure. I'm on really only on Instagram. I got rid of everything. When that guy bought Twitter, I deactivated, and I've been off Facebook for 6 years. Instagram, it's at Motion Worker, which is spelled MOCEAN Worker, one word. Mm-hmm. And the Motion Worker stuff is all like 30s and 40s big band jazz with funky beats. Like my whole thing was like, I love really old music. So I used to love people telling me like, well, your record's kind of old. And I'm like, yeah, it is old. It's about 78 years old. I was like, so you can't tell me it's out of style, because it was made out of style to begin with. So yeah, the Motion Worker stuff is fun. It's like jazz, but it's not, you know, it's like funky, you know. Yeah.
And that's good stuff. Really good stuff.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Adam. We're just honored to have you. We really are. He just Adam is our first guest. If you've been listening to the podcast for a while, he is our first, very first special guest, and he will not be the last, but we're honored that you have actually taken this position.
Amazing. So lovely to catch up with you guys.
And you too, man.
Thanks again.